not the outcome any of us were hoping for. But this is the beginning of something much bigger than us. So thank you. Thank you for the most extraordinary experience I've ever had the honor of being a part of. Thank you for knocking on hundreds of thousands of doors.
John Ossoff giving his concession speech last night after Republican Karen Handel won the special election in Georgia. It was the closest race in the GOP-held district in nearly 40 years. Democrat Ossoff ended up with 48% of the vote. So if Democrats weren't already looking to the 2018 midterms to reclaim losses in last year's election, they certainly are now. Yesterday, a new super PAC called Fight Back California launched. Its mission is to flip seven California seats from red to blue in 2018. We're joined now by Katie Merrill, a Democratic strategist for Fight Back California. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Madeline. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you. And Paul Mitchell is here. He's vice president of Political Data Incorporated. That's a consulting firm. Hi, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, Katie, tell us more about these seven districts. Where are they and how did you choose them?
The seven districts that Fight Back California PAC is focused on are the seven districts that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, but that are held by Republican members. There are two in the Central Valley. There are three in Orange County, one in San Diego, and one in Northern LA County.
And so one of them is held by Daryl Issa, I understand. And he had a squeaker last time around. Do you think that that's an easy one to flip?
I don't think any of these are easy to flip. And I think that's what we've learned from Georgia 6. I think that's what we've learned over the last couple cycles when we've tried to flip at least four of these districts and failed. You can't have the one-size-fits-all out-of-state strategy that comes in 3 months before and tries to flip these districts. And that's why we're launching now. We believe you have to start now, and you have to start talking to these voters now about the issues they care about, and those issues are local issues.
Okay, so what did you learn from last night's election results in Georgia?
Well, we learned that it takes a lot more than money, and it was a four-month campaign, which is the nature of special elections. I still see it as a win for Democrats, a district that was 24 points for the Republican in 2016 and 2 points or 4 points for the Republican in 2017 is fantastic progress and shows all the enthusiasm across the country among Democrats to win back the House. And I think we'll put that to work for Californians in defeating the California 7 in 2018.
Paul, where do you put the chances of flipping these seven seats?
Well, I mean, I think that these are a huge challenge, given the fact that in gubernatorial election cycles, like we're going to see in 2018, we see a vastly different electorate than we just saw in the recent presidential race. So there's a challenge in understanding the likelihood of flipping any of these districts, because if you look at historic data, we would historically see these districts being much more Republican in turnout and much more safer for these members. But we have to balance that with what we're seeing nationally. And as an example, this Georgia 6, that was a district that if it was in California, it would be the third most Republican district in the state. And for that to be even competitive would be kind of a shock if you were to put that in California context. So we have to balance both these things that we're seeing nationally and the emotional stuff and some of the stuff that's not really data-driven, along with what the actual data shows, which is that in gubernatorial election cycles, we usually see a 3 to 4 point advantage for Republicans over what we see in a presidential cycle.
Right. But I imagine that 2018 might be a little different in terms of how fired up people are, given what's been happening in Washington.
That might is something that we can't really calculate. So political data is a data company. We look at voter propensity. We look at historic turnout. And when you look at the data, you get kind of a sour note. It's only when you combine that data with these more atmospheric things like enthusiasm, people going to protests, people watching Sean Spicer press conferences, people watching and being enraged about what's happening on Twitter. So you have to go outside of the hard data to really find evidence that makes you think that the number of these congressional races could be flipped.
And Katie, how do you get people excited to turn out in an off-year election?
Well, I think that's exactly the challenge. But we're finding now that, in fact, There is a tremendous amount of excitement and enthusiasm, and Paul has listed some of the examples of that. And certainly the turnout in Georgia 6 showed that for a special election. It was an extremely, extremely large turnout. But we think that's why we have to start now. That's why the California 7 project to fight back California is so important, to get into these districts now, to tap that Democratic enthusiasm and keep people engaged. And there's so many great groups that are doing this as well, including Swing Left and Indivisible and Flippable and so many more. Keep that Democratic enthusiasm going so that the turnout is exactly what we'd be looking for in 2018.
Now, as you well know, there is a split within the Democratic Party. The Clinton, just for shorthand, the Clinton part, the more sort of standard mainstream part of the party, and then the Bernie Sanders part, and that is playing out here in California with a fight over the party chair of the Democratic Party. Who is your ideal candidate when you consider what happened in Georgia and looking at these districts now? Is it someone who is middle of the road, who can convince moderate Republicans to come over, or is it someone who is more liberal?
I don't think it's about partisanship. I think we have to get away from that. Or the sort of liberal versus moderate binary way of looking at things. You have to go into these districts and find out what these voters care about, the issues that matter most to them, and who is the type of candidate that can speak to those issues and will represent their values. And in some cases, that may be someone who is more on the liberal spectrum or more on the moderate spectrum. But again, I don't really think those labels apply. I think it's about what's important to these voters in these districts.
Okay, I know I have to let you go now. Katie Merrill, Democratic strategist for Fight Back California, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Paul, one last question for you. What do you think the Democrats' strategy overall should be when it comes to ideology and when it comes to presenting a candidate that represents the best chance of winning these districts?
Well, actually, the research, there's been some interesting research with the state's open primary that basically shows that a lot of times these races are cast by the media as being a fight between this partisan or this side of a partisan divide and that side, like with the Sanders versus Clinton divide. But really what voters are voting on has more to do with who's the local person versus the D.C. person, who's the person that's fighting for the issues I care about versus the person who's fighting for other issues. That fascination among the 1% of political engaged people who are watching, everything on Twitter and a lot of the political reporting isn't really how voters vote. It makes for good stories, but when we really look at the data, it's about individual candidates, what they're talking about, and kind of the issues on the ground.
Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
California Democrats are also fighting one of the White House's most important initiatives, and that is cracking down on undocumented immigrants. A bill making its way through the legislature would make all of California a sanctuary state. That bill has divided the state's law enforcement community. This week, LA Police Chief Charlie Beck came out in favor of it, and he's on the line now. Welcome.
How are you?
Great, thanks. Well, why are you in favor of this?
Well, first, I disagree that this is a sanctuary bill. I don't like that term. That's not what the authors refer this bill as. I think it is a label that people use to define things that aren't in this bill.
Why don't you like the term sanctuary?
Well, because I think it's overbroad. I think people think that sanctuary means there's no cooperation with immigration enforcement, that somehow people that are criminals that prey on the public are safe in sanctuary jurisdictions. So it's ill-defined, and I wouldn't have supported this bill had those kind of things been in it. What this bill does is it codifies what the Los Angeles Police Department has been doing for decades, literally four decades, as long as I've been a police officer almost. In that we don't ask about a person's immigration status, we don't arrest people on what are called status offenses, in other words, the civil violation of entering the country illegally absent any criminal act. We don't arrest for that, and haven't for decades. And so that's all in this bill, because the authors want to make sure that the rest of the state follows what we've been doing. It still allows us to work in task forces with federal agencies, including immigration authorities, as long as those task forces aren't solely focused on immigration issues, and that's been our posture for, as I said, for decades. It allows us to arrest people that are in the country illegally and have been priorly deported and have a history of aggravated felonies. It allows us to give information to Homeland Security relative to who we arrest. We do that now through the California law enforcement information system, and so we'll still be able to do that.
Do you ever share immigration information with federal authorities?
Well, I don't have immigration information. You know, that's a federal database. The federal government is the holder of those databases, so I don't have any of that to share. Now, we don't inquire about a person's immigration status when we arrest them. Now, we do make people's information available at time of arrest to the federal government, and they can discern whether or not they're interested in those folks.
The California, as you probably know, the State Sheriff's Association is opposed to this bill. And I just want to play a little clip of tape when I spoke with the Fresno County Sheriff, Margaret Mims, recently. And here's what she had to say about why she allows ICE into her jails.
ICE came to me and they showed me a list of people that were in our custody that were dangerous repeat criminals. And they said, if you don't let us know, these people are going to be out into your community. And I couldn't let that happen. So I invited ICE to come into the jail.
Okay. So I know that you have nothing to do with the jails. You don't run the jails. That's the sheriff's concern here. But do you understand her concern?
Well, and I think that that this bill addresses many of those concerns. First of all, if they're in her jail, I'm assuming that she's prosecuting them. And if she successfully prosecutes them, then I'm assuming that she will sentence them, or they will be sentenced by a court, and that they will complete those sentences. And after they complete those sentences, actually right prior to completing those sentences, this bill mandates that that state detention facilities advise ICE, basically, or Department of Homeland Security, about a person's release 60 days prior. But I think it's very important that local law enforcement not do the federal government's job. You know, the federal government clearly is the enforcer of immigration statutes. I serve the city of Los Angeles, the second biggest city in the nation. Over half of the population that I work for is Hispanic in origin, and probably about 500,000 of the residents of Los Angeles are undocumented. You know, ICE doesn't have the capability to corral these folks. I don't have the capability or the desire to do that either. They are going to be here. And while they are here, I want their cooperation. I want their trust. I want their faith in their ability to be a productive part of Los Angeles. And you know, none of that is going to change. You know, I'm a lifetime Angeleno. I understand this city. I understand this region. You know, we are, you know, in many ways culturally much more tied to our southern border than we are to our eastern power structure. Mm.
Are you already seeing problems in terms of witnesses coming forward or people filing complaints, maybe domestic violence complaints, for example, because people are afraid that they will be arrested on immigration?
Well, you know, it's hard to draw an absolute conclusion, you know, based on, you know, just the limited data we have. But over the past 6 months, we have seen a reduction in 911 calls in some of our strongest Hispanic communities. We have seen a reduction in reports of domestic violence in those same communities, and we have seen a reduction in reports of sexual assault in those same communities, and this does not correlate with a reduction in the rest of the city.
Mm. Now, what about immigration officers identifying themselves as police officers? Is that a big problem?
Well, I think it's part of the whole issue. The issue being that people should not see their local police as immigration enforcement officers. And so, you know, our desire is that we do less things, not more things, that confuse that issue. And this is one of those things that confuses that issue. You know, it isn't the only thing. You know, I think SB 54 is designed to reduce some of that confusion also, recognizing that there are federal statutes that make immigration enforcement the sole responsibility of the federal government. I have too much to do the federal government's job.
Are you worried, though, that they will say, okay, then you're not going to get any federal funding anymore?
Well, I wouldn't like that, but that, you know, the money is not the driving factor in what I do. You know, you can't buy police in Los Angeles.
LA Police Chief Charlie Beck, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And we'd like to hear what you think. Should California be a so-called sanctuary state? Are you concerned that violent criminals might slip through the system? You can let us know your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, truckers at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach can end up working up to 20 hours a day for pennies. How a push for clean air led to their exploitation, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Modern-day indentured servants. That's how USA Today described the lives of Southern California's port truckers after a year-long investigation into that industry. Some truckers regularly work 20-hour days and make little in the way of take-home pay. They have to finance their own trucks, which many of them can't afford in the first place. And if they miss payments or they get sick or just run afoul of their bosses, they can lose the truck and the thousands, tens of thousands of dollars they have paid into it. And because the truckers are classified as independent contractors rather than employees, they have little protection under the law. This week, some truckers who work at the ports in LA and Long Beach went on strike again. It's the 15th strike in 4 years to bring attention to their working conditions. Brett Murphy reported the story for USA Today, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, tell us first, who are these people and what are they doing? These are not long-haul truckers, right?
Yeah, that's right. So they do the first kind of leg of the supply chain in America. So they actually take shipping containers off of the pier down in L.A. and Long Beach, and then they'll bring them to a warehouse or a train depot nearby, usually like 5 or 50 miles away. So it's one little link in a really long supply chain. And about 90%, more than 90% of them are immigrants from Central and South America. There's about 16,000 of these guys all over the L.A. harbor down there.
Okay. And you talked to one man who made just 67 cents in 1 week.
Yeah, that's
How
right.
How is that
yeah.
possible?
So these guys get paid by the container, so it depends how many they're able to move. And if work is slow, it can really cut into their pay. And why that is because the company deducts all the costs of doing business right from their paycheck, right? So they take lease payments for the truck, they take insurance, diesel, a lot of other fees like drug testing and parking fees, all right out from their paycheck. So if they're not able to move enough containers, or if work is slow, or if there's bad traffic, they can be in the red. They can take home cents after the whole week. I saw some guys who would actually owe their boss money at the end of the week. They would get like a negative paycheck. It would look like an invoice.
The main issue here is the leasing of the trucks. So talk about that and how that came to be. Why are they leasing these trucks?
Yeah, so it's sort of the center of this whole thing. It started about a decade ago. So all these guys used to own their own trucks. These were clunkers. They had like 2 million miles on them. And the state kind of banned old trucks from coming into the port because they were spewing diesel into the air. The state said, no more old trucks. So all these companies looked around at one another and they said, what are we going to do? Our contractors, our independent contractors, can't afford new clean trucks. They cost $100,000. So what the companies decided to do, kind of all together all at once, was draw up these lease-to-own agreements. So one day the trucker walks into work. He slid a pile of documents and they say, hey, listen, your truck can't operate here anymore. If you want to keep working, if you want to go home with a paycheck at the end of this week, sign this thing. We got a truck waiting for you out back, and after 5 or 7 years, you can own the thing. They didn't translate the contract. They didn't really explain them. They wouldn't let some guys take them home, and most of these guys can't read English anyway, but they needed to keep working, so they said okay, and they signed, and then they got in the truck.
Okay, so they're basically working off this payment to the truck, which doesn't ever seem to end, right? But at the same time, you report that they're working these crazy hours, like 20-hour days in many instances, or even being literally locked out of the parking lot, like they can't leave. So why is that happening?
Yeah, so once the company owners sort of figured out what they had here, was debt peonage. So their guys, their workers owe them X amount of dollars every week. They know that. And by controlling these guys' schedules and what containers they can pick up and their pay, they realize they can kind of make them do whatever they want. And a lot of times I found drivers said that they would use that to make them work 14, 16, 18, 20 hours a day. And the driver said that they felt like they had absolutely no choice because if they say no, then they don't get to work the next day. If they don't get to work the next day, then they don't take anything home at the end of the week. So they have no choice, and the company's figured out that they can kind of hang this weekly debt over their heads like an anvil.
And they don't quit because they think, well, I've spent so much to try to get this truck. I don't want to lose that money.
Right. Yeah, that's what it really came down to. I asked a lot of guys, hey, why don't you leave? This sounds like a nightmare. You know, why are you doing this? Why are you working these crazy hours sometimes for pennies after the whole week? And they say, well, listen, I've already paid 3 years into this thing. I just had to refinance my home. I just had to file for bankruptcy. I just lost my home. If I leave now, I'd be leaving tens of thousands on the table in years of my life I put into this thing. I can't just walk away. You know, there are some guys who did. There's some guys who had to quit. Some people call that starving them out of the truck. That's when the company realizes the driver's getting close to paying it off, so they'll stop giving them good work or they'll stop paying them what they should be, and then they'll just hope that the guys will quit so they never ask for the truck.
But do any of the guys actually win their truck? Do they actually pay it off?
Yeah, sure, they do. And that's the first thing the companies will say to you when you ask them about this whole thing. They say, listen, you found a lot of very disgruntled workers, mostly former workers, but we have plenty of guys who were able to do it. I've met a couple. I haven't met that many, but they say there's a lot out there. You know, but back when they were starting this thing, a lot of places, a lot of studies, even a trucking financing firm projected that at least 40% of these guys would probably default on these things. Everyone was sort of telling them, you know, there's going to be foreclosures with these trucks. There's no way these guys can finance $100,000. You can't pass it on to them. But it was a volatile moment in the industry. The economy was taking a turn, so they thought that they had no choice but to do it.
Well, meanwhile, many of them, 1,200 or so, have filed claims in civil court or with the California Department of Industrial Relations. And judges in nearly all of these cases have sided with the truckers and said that they cannot be classified as independent contractors. So why does this still persist?
Well, they sort of end right there, right where you just said it. Every one of these is a case-by-case basis. So what they do is they might rule in favor of a driver, but all they're really saying is that you have to pay that driver what he's owed. They don't tell the company you have to reclassify your drivers or you have to change this business practice because it's a federal law. It's part of deregulation that states and cities can't come in and tell any company involved in interstate commerce how to run their business.
Okay, so these guys are on strike now, as I said. This is the 15th strike in 4 years. So what possibly can they receive in terms of redress for all of this?
Well, what they're trying to do, and the Teamsters are spearheading a lot of it, they're trying to put pressure on companies and on local officials. So right now the mayors of L.A. and Long Beach. And what they're trying to do is call attention to the fact that so many of these workers So many of these drivers are in really, really tough straits because of what these companies did. And they're hoping that by enough pressure and enough public awareness around it, the companies will start to lose money. Their customers won't like the public relations and they'll drop off. And they're hoping all this will create sort of pressure for the companies to change their ways. And they've been trying for years, and they so far have chipped away, but it's been a long road for them, and they're still trying.
Well, what could the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, do?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have that question pending with the mayor right now, as well as with the Teamsters. Like, hey, what are you actually looking for them to do?
And meanwhile, their customers are big companies like Target or Amazon or Walmart. And I guess they could pressure these trucking companies to stop these practices.
Yeah. So the one company I found that actually did something was Goodyear. But most other retailers I talked to, most other big importers, you know, the Home Depots, Walmarts, Targets of the world, they said they didn't know about these things. They said, listen, these are contractors of subcontractors. We don't even hire the trucking companies, let alone the truck drivers. So as much as we encourage all of our vendors to follow the law, and it's part of our code of ethics, it's not really up to us to be policing it and making sure they do it.
Brett Murphy, you can read his year-long investigation into the port trucking business at USA Today. It's called Rigged. Brett, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with a reporter who sits down with terrorist leaders.
There was a bazooka in one corner, an AK-47 in the other corner. There was the black flag at the wall. And I don't know if you remember, but this man has beheaded people.
Washington Post reporter Suad McKennett on how being a Muslim woman helps in her reporting. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In the summer of 2014, journalist Suad McKennett was preparing herself for a very important interview. And like any good reporter, McKennett packed her notebook and pen. But from there, her interview prep veers sharply from the norm. She left her cell phone and all forms of identification in her hotel room. She gave emergency contacts to a colleague in case she was kidnapped. And she was driven for nearly an hour to a restaurant at the Turkish-Syrian border. And there she got into another car where she finally met her interview subject, the head of the Islamic State's hostage program. That is the opening chapter to McKennett's new memoir about her career covering terrorism. It's called I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. And in it, she recounts her meetings with some of the most wanted members of ISIS, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda while reporting for The New York Times and now The Washington Post. And Suad McKennett joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, why did you want to meet this man?
Well, this was a couple of weeks after the so-called Islamic State, the Caliphate, was declared. And we all were wondering what exactly is the Caliphate or what were the objectives of this group. And I believed it was important to speak to somebody from the group. And one of my conditions was also I wanted to speak to somebody who was high levels, who had authority. But I didn't know that this man was, in fact, somebody also responsible for the Western hostages and that he had also participated in torturing some of our colleagues and had actually also overseen so-called Jihadi John, the man who was hiding behind the black mask and who was beheading some of our colleagues. I didn't know that when I interviewed him.
When you found out later, did you think, oh my God, why did I meet with him? I could have been kidnapped. I could have been beheaded myself.
You know, during the interaction, I pushed back a couple of times and I challenged him. So when he spoke about this is a jihad, I would, you know, I challenged him and I said, look, this is not the kind of jihad that our grandfathers fought, for example. And I explained to him the rules of jihad that, you know, that I knew were the rules of jihad. For example, you're not supposed to kill innocent people. You're even not supposed to harm a tree. And there was a moment where I realized he grew angry, and I saw that in his pocket he had something that looked like a gun, and I decided to back off a little and not to go on with challenging him. But later, when I found out who he was, I know his identity, but I don't tell the reader the identity because he's still active. He's alive, and I thought for a couple of minutes, this could have gone terribly wrong. Yes, he could have just taken me over to ISIS territory, and I probably wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
Has that changed the way that you report now?
I'll tell you very honestly, after this meeting with him, along the drive that we took together, I had the offer of going inside into the caliphate. But here's the point, Madeline. I'm an unmarried Muslim woman. Now, somebody else who I had known from previous years of reporting who had joined ISIS reached out to me individually and said to me, look, I heard that you got the offer to come here, but I just want you to know that, A, if you ask questions, and I know that you will ask questions that are very critical. Some people here are very angry and they might see it as you're a spy. They will call you a spy and then they will basically, put you in prison. You will be tortured. And then you will be asked to, you will become something like a slave. That's one possibility. The other possibility is because you're also an unmarried Muslim woman, somebody says, well, you know what? I actually like her. So they will force you into marriage. And my editor at the Washington Post said, no way, that's not going to happen. So that's something, we wouldn't do due to security reasons.
Mm. In fact, you describe in your book several encounters with men. Mm-hmm. They're all men, of course, leading these groups. And they do ask you about your marital status. One of them, or a couple of them, even suggest that you could become one of his wives.
Yeah.
Did you find that was, obviously was probably uncomfortable for you, but did you find that that also helped you gain access to these guys and be able to ask them questions that perhaps a male journalist and a Western journalist couldn't ask?
So that's a very interesting point you're raising here because, I for a couple of years I did this kind of reporting together with my very nice colleague Michael Moss, and we
from the New York Times,
who used to be at the New York Times, and we went to a talk together, and then somebody asked him what was the most interesting thing for you also to learn or to see when you went with, Suad McKennett into the world of jihad. And he said, here's the interesting dynamics. I'm going with this woman who grew up and who's actually a Western Muslim woman. And he said, if I would have asked those questions, they would have killed me right away. But she asked them the questions and they answer. And not only this, they actually are so fascinated, they want to get married to her. In the meantime, she has actually issues finding a good guy in our world. So there were moments where we played a little bit with the situation, but there were also moments that were very uncomfortable. Like when you are, when you sit with a leader of the Taliban or somebody who's higher up within Al-Qaeda, and he sits with other members of his groups and he makes you this kind of offer, you cannot just say, you have to be very diplomatic in how to say no to those leaders. So there were some challenging times as well.
Yeah, there's one meeting, you're in this very, very tense meeting, and you talk back to one of the leader, I suppose, or one of the deputy.
Yeah, the deputy.
And it could have gone in two different ways.
Yeah, it was one of those moments. I actually You know, when you mention what role does it play that you're a woman, or maybe even a woman of Arab descent or of Muslim descent. Here I am in Lebanon. This was Shaka al-Absi. He was an associate of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and he actually was also responsible for the killing of an American diplomat in Jordan. And he refused to give interviews. And then I spoke to him. I insisted to like speak to him just for a couple of minutes on the phone. And I said, okay, forget the interview. But you know what? I'm an Arab Muslim woman. I came from Europe. How about tea? Let's just have tea. And you know, it would be very rude if you say no to somebody who comes and asks you to have tea with him. And he was like, whoa. A couple of minutes later, he said, okay, come for tea, but you have to come alone. That's also one of the reasons why the title is I Was Told to Come Alone. And I went with my contact person to this supposedly tea meeting, but it turned into an interrogation. And not only this, I found myself in a room where there was a bazooka in one corner, an AK-47 in the other corner, there was the black flag at the wall, and I don't know if you remember, but this was an associate of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And mm-hmm. this man has beheaded people in front of this flag. So I saw the scenery and said, what is going on here? And then a couple of other men came in and somebody was pointing a gun at me during the interrogation. So and then there's Absi and his deputy. And then the deputy at some stage asks, after all these like tough questions, he asked me, Sister Suad, are you married? And I was like, oh, here you go again. Somebody who wants, you know, was looking for a second wife. And I answered back, no, but why are you looking for a second wife? And what happened then was everybody laughed in the room except him. He became, silent and pale. And Absi, the leader of the group, turns to him, his deputy, and says, well, I don't know if my daughter would have allowed you to, you know, would allow you to take a second wife now. And I said, oops, that's the son-in-law. Well, and it was
so, but he found it. He found it funny, Absi.
Absi found it funny, and also the rest of the group found it funny. And I believe this was one of the reasons why he ended up giving me the interview.
Wow. Yeah. You are very brave.
You know, I look, the scene, and I describe it in the book, after the interview, there were a couple of boys playing, maybe 5-6 years old, not older. And then one of the boys, he carried like a plastic gun, and he comes to one of the fighters and he says, daddy, we played killing the disbelievers, the kuffar, and I killed a lot of them. And then this man kisses him and says, I'm very proud of you, my son. And, you know, when I went back to the hotel, I finished transcribing the interview and everything, but then I actually cried. And those kind of things, yes, some people would say you're brave, others said you're crazy, but they also affect you as a journalist, because I saw the next generation of, you know, of people who grew up with hatred.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Suad McKennett. She's a national security correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book called I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. Now, you grew up in Germany, mainly of Moroccan and Turkish descent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are passages in your book where you say you understand why these guys do this. You understand how it feels to feel disenfranchised. And by these guys, I mean the so-called homegrown terrorists in Europe.
So I say I understand why somebody would fall into the arms of recruiters. I don't understand and also don't excuse when somebody kills innocent people. There is no excuse for it. But a lot of people ask me, how does it work? Like, why are they joining ISIS? Why are they joining Al-Qaeda? Why are they joining all these groups? And whenever I sit with those who were radicalized, it's very interesting because they don't discuss religion with me. They discuss politics. They discuss how they grew up in Europe and how they felt at some stage in their age that you know, they wanted to be part of the society, as they describe it, and then they couldn't be really a full member of the society, or they felt they couldn't be a full member of the society because of their background. And I, you know, it might sound to some people as, well, that's maybe exaggerated, but I have lived it myself. So I was really growing up in a family that wanted me to be part of the society, and that and I wanted to become a journalist from the age of 13 when I watched All the President's Men, the movie. I was inspired by this, but there were moments where, like, for example, children in our neighborhood, German children, were not allowed to play with us because, you know, we were the guest worker kids. There were moments where when I saw that the houses of Turkish families were burning in Germany in the early 90s, I felt threatened. Now, I was lucky because I had this kind of environment. I had parents who understood this. I had godparents who were Germans. I had members from a Jewish community, from the Muslim community, who took care of it. But not everybody is as lucky as I was. And so I do understand the moment where somebody feels I cannot be a full member of the society, they reject me. And, you know, Madeline, I always say, if somebody feels that he or she can be a full member of a society and can make it in a society, they will do whatever they can to protect the society. The moment they feel they cannot be part of the society, that's a moment where the recruiter, whether it's an ISIS recruiter or whether it's an Al-Qaeda recruiter, steps in and they give them an alternative.
So this has been going on for a long time. You've been reporting on this since 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the book, you describe how this has come home to you. One of your relatives, a young man, is killed in a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
And you look at his grieving mother and you say in the book, "Watching her, I was filled with anger and guilt, anger because it seemed we hadn't learned much from the suffering from the past 15 years and that I, along with other journalists, had clearly failed."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So here you have been dedicating your career and taking risks with your life to explain this jihad, these terrorist groups, and you feel like you failed, that we still don't understand what's happening?
Well, you know, my cousin's son, John, he died. I mean, it was a surreal moment because I was sent to Munich to cover the story. Everybody thought the shooter was inspired by ISIS. It turned out the shooter was actually inspired by the right wing extremist ideology. Yes, I felt that we that I as a journalist did, you know, I was trying all my career to help people see what was going on, how indoctrination works, and whether we talk about ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or about right-wing indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has parallelities, and those are indoctrinations or ideologies of hatred. And I, in that, you know, moment, I felt that we failed them. Yes, because, you know, they were ISIS is not going to go away just because they are losing ground in Syria and Iraq. The radicalization processes are still going on. The voices of people who are trying to divide societies are getting stronger, and I also make the point in the book that we have to understand it's not Islam that is radicalizing people. Actually, those people are radicalizing Islam, and it's we are living in a time I don't see a clash of civilizations or religions going on. I don't think that is the point. The point is, we as societies are dealing with people who are fighting against bridge builders. And this became so clear to me. And I, you know, the moment where they handed over the body to the family and I had to go because nobody else in the family was able to do it, to you know, to look at him, because we had to decide whether his mother could see him. He was shot a couple of times, and these are moments you will never forget in your life. And to me, this was a point where I said, how many more parents will have to cry for their kids, for their children, before we as societies understand we have to, you know, we have to look at what's going on inside our societies. How can we stop hatred? And that's also why I decided to write this chapter.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. The book is called I Was Told to Come Alone, My Journey Behind the Lines of Jihad. And the author is Suad McKennett. Okay, a little dessert now, savory dessert. We're going to talk about avocado toast and why it persists and why, despite the cliche, it is not a Californian invention. That story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Avocado toast. Whether you love it, love to hate it, or just hate it, it's not going anywhere. Today, the New York Times published a guide to the best in LA, which may mean it is going away. But it is still a big selling point for chefs in places like Jelena, Squirrel, Honey High. Restaurants are adding specialty toppings like pickled shallots and tomato confit to give their toast an edge. But where did the idea of smashing avocados on bread even come from? Here to dig into this is Jane Orenstein of The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, The New York Times is using avocado toast in their series on regional foods, and they've pinned it to Southern California. But you have done some historical research, I understand. Where did it come from?
Yeah, I was also curious where this came from. So I started searching on the internet and couldn't find a source. But I did kind of track it back to this restaurant in New York, Cafe Hutton, and the chef there, Chloe Osborne. And she was from Australia, and she said she had eaten it growing up. And that's where I kind of saw it had taken off more in Australia a little bit before it came to the U.S., the avocado toast as we know it now.
So Australia, New York, finally, Southern California. But why is it so associated with Southern California?
Well, I think obviously avocados are grown in California. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to be popular where it's grown. That's why in Australia, in the area of Queensland where she ate it, that's why it was popular there. And Mexico, obviously, they've been putting avocado on things, smashing avocado on things. So they kind of have their own version of avocado toast, maybe not on bread, maybe it's on a tostada. Avocado tostada is a joke that the chef Patty Yenich made when I asked her about it. So it seems to be wherever there are avocados, people will put it on top of things.
But it's really associated with a certain kind of, I don't know, ethos, maybe the goop ethos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's expensive, yes, too. We looked at the menu item at Go Get 'Em Tiger in Los Feliz. Avocado toast is $10.50 without an egg or salmon, and then it's more. I mean, that's not cheap.
Right. I think people are always surprised how much avocado toast costs, but avocados themselves are pretty expensive.
Right.
I think in my supermarket, it's about $2 for an avocado right now. And I mean, there's a lot of labor. If you looked at all the avocado toasts on the list that the New York Times put together, they weren't simply avocado smashed on bread. It was like a very specific type of bread and very specific toppings that were made. And then obviously the restaurant wants to make a profit, so they're not going to just charge you the bare minimum.
Right.
Especially if there's a lot of labor involved.
Yeah. So this is just this, as we said, it's not just a California thing. You're in D.C. Is it a big deal there?
At certain restaurants, it's definitely on the menu. You know, I think a lot of hipper cafes have it. I personally am a big fan of avocado toast still, and I make it all the time. I would say it's not just you have to be in the area of avocados being grown to experience it.
It is very tasty, but it is something that you can do at home pretty easily. I mean, it's not like making hummus, which takes a lot of effort.
Yes. That's why I think I was most intrigued about it, because I saw one of my favorite blogs, Smitten Kitchen. She posted a recipe for avocado toast. And I was like, I need a recipe for avocado toast? Like, how what goes into it? And obviously, Gwyneth Paltrow's recipe had kind of taken over the internet when that came out from her cookbook. So there are recipes out there for a very, very simple dish, or one that can be very simple.
So what was in that recipe? What's so great about that recipe that you wanted to make it?
For the Smitten Kitchen one, it's you smash the avocado, and I think there's lemon juice, there's chili flakes. It's very simple, but it was a very specific method of what makes it. And she was copying Cafe Hitton, so the recipe that Chloe Osborne had started there back in the early 2000s.
Okay. Is avocado toast here to stay, do you think?
I think so. I think it's kind of like the dish of this era, kind of like, you know, like Caesar salad or a Cobb salad or something that kind of it'll probably get recreated many times over. But I think the basic avocado toast is here to stay.
Jane Orenstein, video journalist at The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Christian Bordahl.
Hello, Madeline Brand.
Are you an
How
avocado
are you?
Toaster yourself?
Yes. Yeah, I am an avocado toaster. I have been known to toast and put some avocado on it. And a lot of our listeners apparently are really into the avocado toast too. Riot Squirrel says, I put avocado on toast. That's my secret recipe. And Julian Trang says, wait, people actually pay someone to spread smashed avocado on toast, sprinkle tomatoes and seasoning to taste? Jackson Parker says, love the toasted blacktop coffee. It's my favorite way to start the morning. Moore Johan says, I lost my house because I ate too much avocado toast, so no comment. Rick Hassan says, you can live on the second floor right under the half-cut tomato. And it goes on and on. Check it out on Instagram and
elsewhere.
People have
opinions on avocado toast. They have things to say. Okay, if you want to weigh in, please do. Or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.